This podcast is a member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com.
This is Tori from the Dead Game Society. Welcome to our podcast, the DGS. We play with dead things.
Hello again, and welcome back to episode 5 of the Dead Game Society podcast. I'm your host, Chad. Michael and Colin aren't here today, but I have a special treat made possible by the folks over at Gamehole Con. And remember, if you're interested in attending Gamehole Con, you can find more information about them on their website at www.gameholecon.com. As I was saying, last week, the guys over at Gamehole Con made it possible for me to get a chance to interview one of their special guests, Ed Greenwood, the creator of The Forgotten Realms. During my time talking to him, we talked all about gaming, writing, and his upcoming appearance at the Gamehole convention. But you know what? Why have me tell you about it? Listen to it for yourself. Welcome to a special interview edition of the Dead Game Society podcast. Today I'm really excited to have on the show as a guest Ed Greenwood, a game designer and author responsible for, among many other things, the creation of the Forgotten Realms setting for the Dungeons & Dragons game. And before we get into it, I would also like to thank Alex Kamer and all the crew from the Gamehole Convention for making this interview possible to do on behalf of both the Gamehole Convention group as well as the Dead Game Society. That will be between November the 7th and the 9th at the Sheridan Madison Hotel in Madison, Wisconsin. And you can go to, I believe the event registration is open right now, and you can go to their website at www.gameholecon.com. So anyway, so why don't I just start off, Ed, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Hello and all that.
Well, Ed, just so you know, the Dead Game Society, which we always say with love, we're a group that likes to talk all about games that are out of print or editions out of print. We put that loophole in because we love Dungeons & Dragons and some of the other games. And so we said, well, we are going to talk about the older editions then. So as always, I always say, you know, the Dead Game Society, we say that with love. Speaking of the Gamehole convention coming up in Madison, Ed, why don't you tell us a little bit about your involvement in that?
Well, I'm going to be a guest at Gamehole this year, you know, barring unforeseen mischance, like we always say. And at Gamehole, I hope to play a lot of games, meet a lot of folks, talk about maybe running a long-term campaign or something of the sort. And I know Chris Perkins from Wizards of the Coast will be there, and we want to do a panel together where we sit down and spill upcoming secrets of the realms.
That sounds awesome. Okay, so Ed, can I just ask, now, Gamehole Con is kind of a newer convention. What was it that made you decide to attend that convention?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I'd been asked to attend Gamehole on previous years. People from Gamehole would come up to me at Gen Con and other conventions I was attending and say, hey, you should come on down. Here's our con. You know, and I thought, this sounds really fun. You know, anybody who would call a convention Gamehole, that sounds fun to me.
It's a unique name, isn't it?
I want to know more. Conflicted with stuff I was already doing, and some of that stuff was top secret hush-hush stuff for Wizards of the Coast, and I wasn't at home, so I couldn't go to the convention. I was doing that other stuff, and that was arranged in, you know, well in advance, and I'd have to say, I can't this year, I'm sorry. But of course, every time you say that, you think, yeah, I really want to go. I mean, there have been conventions this year that I haven't been able to attend for all sorts of really good real-life reasons, not just because I don't want to go there. No, this, I very much want to go there. And I've looked at the website and I say, I want to meet Luke Gygax. Oh, a chance to sit down with Chris and talk some more stuff. Good. Oh, look at all these other – I want to meet all these people. So I want to go to Gamehole for that. And it sounds like it's great. So, hey, I want to be there.
Yeah, well, it was a blast when we went last year. The Dead Game Society guys, we got to be good friends with Alex and all the other guys that run the convention over there. So we've just, you know, they run a good convention. Alex has got a very good organizational mind, and he's put it to work at that convention. And it's just, I really think you'll have a good time.
Cool.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you there. So there's that.
Can't wait. We have to get together.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, so Ed, why don't you tell us then, are you going to be running games at the Gamehole convention, correct?
Sure, yeah. I want the chance to run games, and, you know, for the society, you should probably know that I'm most comfortable running second edition.
Oh, yeah. I know Forgotten Realms had a lot to do with so that was like the primary setting, I believe, for the second edition.
Yes. Yeah. That's so awful. I prefer second edition just because I don't have to think about it. And
okay.
Although my games tend to get a bit close to the bone for young kids, you know, more like 18 plus, they're also good for novices. So, you know, if your grandmother came to the convention and had never played D&D before, that's okay. Being at my table is like ham acting. Not as in knowing the rules.
Ah, so there's a lot of improv going on.
Yes, yeah. We role play.
Excellent.
We don't worry about rules, and you know, we roll dice on occasion for fun.
Yeah, I'm actually of that school myself. The games I run, I tend to focus more on the role play aspect as opposed to, I guess, you know, the dice rolling per se. I just think it's more fun when the people are getting into it and they're really enjoying their characters and a good story is being told. That's the way I like to go with it, too. But
yeah,
now,
great.
You're also going to be releasing a anthology of short stories called A Platter of Surprises?
Volume 3 of Platter of Surprises. I do these little things as sort of, a collection of usually 5 short stories in ebook form. And I tend to theme them and call them A Platter of Surprises, Volume 1, Volume 2, Volume 3. And I think it's the turn of the naughty one, A Congress of Delightful Naughtiness, Platter of Surprises, Volume 3, for Gamehole. It's merely a coincidence. These are, erotica. Explicit.
Okay.
2 of the stories are very hardcore. Most of them are light on profanity. And all but one of them are fantasy swords and sorcery short stories. And that has nothing directly to do with Dungeons & Dragons. It's just stuff I wrote for fun for me. And it was like, well, why don't I put this out there? You know, so people can yell at me. So...
Well, you know, that brings up some, I like to write as well. And one of the things that, you know, I always wonder is, you know, say in your position, you've done so much in the gaming world. Do you ever find that, you know, how much, to what degree does one influence the other interest, the writing interest, as opposed to the game creation design interest?
They influence each other and benefit each other, I'd say, all the time, back and forth. In a novel, you have word count that you almost never have in a game adventure. Because up until now, and now I mean when we can e-publish, up until now you have to pay for paper. And you have to, you know, there's a certain amount of little squiggles of ink you can print on that paper, which costs money. So there's always a limit to the size of a printed product. The main thing is, to cut to the adventure, usually. Because usually, I mean, there are exceptions. If you go back into the past, Vault of the Drow and Queen of the Demoid Pits, those are giving you almost entire settings in an adventure. But usually, it's, can we keep the adventure moving along on paper? Because there are people who are going to play it with a set time limit, such as, say, a tournament at a convention, for instance, or... There are people who play Dungeons & Dragons with a style that isn't interested in heavy-duty campaign role-playing. So they just, you know, come on, show me the next monster, you know, sort of thing. And so, for a variety of reasons, you tend to leave out oodles of backstory, the motivations in depth, and side intrigues of the non-player characters, particularly if they're non-player character monsters. Unless they're a dragon or a beholder or something that you look in your rulebook and say, oh, this thing is as intelligent as me or more, you know, except for that. You see, yeah, the monster's there to eat me or kill me. You know, we don't go beyond that. But in a novel, you not only have space to do that, you want to do that. But at the same time, the game benefits the novel writing because a novelist can say, oh, and then we went here and then we went here, and they're going to gloss over that. That doesn't work if you're dungeon mastering, because the players are going to look around behind the false front of the building and say, what's back there? Or you're chasing them down a street with all of your NPCs, so they're supposed to run away, and they say, no, let's turn down this alleyway, hide, wait till everybody runs past, and then we'll go back out the other way. And therefore, the dungeon master has to know where everything is. Everything has to be explained. Everything has to fit together, because the players can go in any direction. And that's something a novelist doesn't have to worry about, because they're making all of those choices, which way the story goes. And they can just leave you out. Now, the classic thing, when I was growing up, if there was anything salacious in the story, the story writer would usually close the bedroom door in the reader's face. You just didn't get to see what went on in there, which was fine, you know. But, I mean, that was a choice. That could all be left out of the book. But Dungeon Master doesn't have that luxury. They have to be ready for the players to jump in every direction. And as a result, when I'm writing books, whether or not it makes it down onto the page, I'm always thinking, okay, what if the hero decides to do this instead? So I have to have it all worked out. Not necessarily written out exhaustively, but I think it leads to better books because you aren't just sloughing it off. You know, the thing we see on classic Western movies where the guy fires his six gun 72 times.
Uh-huh.
Because the guy was just writing that he was caught up in the heat of the moment and they were moving along and that looked cool and sounded cool. That fitted the story. Done. Boom, we're done. Nuh-uh. Not if you're thinking in campaign mode for gaming, because you're always thinking, okay, where did he get the bullets? Where will he get more when he runs out? Did he bring along?
How long will it take him to reload?
Yeah.
Well, you know, on the writing subject, I know that there are a lot of gamers out there who would enjoy writing. Do you have any advice you might give to them if that was something they really wanted to pursue?
Sure. Take every piece of advice with a grain of salt from any writer, because we all write differently, okay? There is no one true way to write. But I would say the first thing to do is read, read, read. Read voraciously. Read stuff you love. Read stuff you hate as well as stuff you love. Why do you hate it? Try and figure out why, you know, when you're reading. Read all genres, not just the one that most turns your crank. What works in storytelling? What doesn't?
Uh-huh.
Bear in mind when something works in another medium, such as television or movie, because they are a different story form. What you can do with mood music and traveling shots and so on, you can't do on the page when you're just writing. The reader's own imagination has to supply all that stuff. So you have to describe what the monster looks like rather than just having them see it visually. Stuff like that. There's shorthand. You know, the old thing about you knew when something bad was going to happen in an old movie because the entire orchestra was out in the middle of the haunted mansion or the forest in the middle of the night going, dee, dee, dee. And building up, you know, and you, you can't do that in the same way on the printed page. So you want to try looking at everything, what works and what doesn't work. That's step one. And step two is write, write, write. After you read, 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 write, write, write. And like everything, like learning how to drive a car, you get better at it the more practice you have. You become better by doing over and over again. The old thing about, you know, the first time you're in a kitchen and you're staring at all this stuff, oh, geez, all these dials, what do I do? How do I not burn that? You follow the recipe, right?
Uh-huh.
But you're not confident with it yet. You haven't done it often enough to just sort of do it as second nature and worry about the little new things I've never done this before, but never mind. I know all the other stuff. So I'll just do it without thinking, turn on the burners. That's got to come up to heat. Make sure I got the butter out, all this stuff it just becomes second nature. That's the bit that you have to do by writing, writing, writing. You have to get to where you can tell a coherent story with a beginning, middle, and an end, hit what some writers call borrowing from television movies, beats in the story. The mm-hmm. moments, yeah, get to be able to do that without thinking. Then you can think about what you have to think about for this particular story to be most effective. You know, when I have that moment when the two guys are on the floor struggling for control of the dagger, I want my reader to sympathize with that guy, not this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for that to happen, I have to have done these things beforehand. How can I sharpen it up? Now, again, when I said at the beginning, take that advice with a grain of salt, because that's anathema to some writers. They write instinctively. They don't write by thinking it through like that. I don't write by thinking it through like that. I write instinctively. I've been doing it for so long now, and I read everything that was in my father's den when I was like 3, 4, 5 years old. I read everything. Dry as dust academic writing. What passed in the 1940s and 50s for porn, you know, which by today's standards is incredibly tame. And all this pulp stuff that, you know, give one to a friend in uniform, you know, when you're finished reading the book. So, and some of it was beautifully written, some of it was execrably written. But that's okay. I learned from all of it.
Yeah, and you hear a lot of writers that will say, you know, one, you read everything, but also the advice is often, you know, if you're going to write fantasy, you shouldn't only read fantasy, like you were saying. You should read out in almost every genre, because you can learn something that you can bring back to your fantasy from just about any genre.
Oh, sure. Okay, if you're writing a doorstop fantasy novel, okay, if you're going to be the next Robert Jordan, or you think, you intend, you hope, and this book is going to be 3 inches thick, okay, I can almost guarantee that it's going to have certain things in it. Nobles or even royalty, usually royalty, or a struggle to become such a thing, or to redeem your name, or step out of the shadows of obscurity as the long-hidden bastard offspring of, and reclaim the throne, or something of the sort. That means you're going to have to do a lot of character development, and it might be really handy to read romances of the right sort. How do they present these good-looking characters, or off-putting characters? And if you're reading your standard romance, in which it isn't into the bed in page 3, there's a lot of courtship and rebuffing and misunderstandings and tension and one or two characters competing for the affections of a third or whatever that take up most of the book before you get to the naughty stuff. Well, those are the scenes you want to see. How do you build that? Also, read a historical novel, say one of the ones about court intrigue at the time of Henry VIII or Elizabeth I. How do they handle the intrigue at court? Then open a mystery when you've got your classic country house mystery, by which I mean, and sometimes there are houses in the country, in the English countryside or not, but what I mean is a bunch of people in a building or situation, whether it's a submarine or whatever, so you have a set cast of characters. They can't leave, they can't enter. It's the people on stage, one of them must have done it, sort of thing. And then how the author shows you each character, you know, when they first walk on and they describe them the first time, how did they do that? Did it work? Did it not work? Can you use that technique? How does the writer make you afraid of a character who is, after all, just squiggles of ink on a page when they first walk in the door? Steal that. Uh-huh. How did they do it? Steal it. Write it your way. Write it 16 times. Then you know how to do it. Oh, okay, I can do this now. I can put that in my doorstop fantasy. I can now handle a large cast of characters without them being a whole bunch of names full of Q's and X's and Z's and V's that are going to drive the standard reader batty trying to figure out who all these names are, because they're just names. You've got to bring them all alive.
Exactly.
And good writers can bring a cast of 20, 30, 40 characters, George Ray Road Martin, Julian May in her Pleiadian Exile stuff, Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings. There are large casts.
Frank Herbert.
Yeah, Frank Herbert. Well, all of them, and some of them, like, say, Roger Zelazny when he was doing Amber.
Oh, I love
family
those
members. And it's all intrigue within the family members. And yet, he manages to make that cartload of princes all different from each other and distinct in your mind.
Oh, exactly. I mean, if you talk to any fan of the Chronicles of Amber, they're going to, you know, you'll quickly get into a conversation about the different members of the family to such a degree. It's almost like everybody feels like they know each individual one. You know who Brand is. You know who Blaze is. And that's the skill of Roger Zelazny in bringing that characterization. And what's amazing is he's bringing that characterization from a first-person narration, which is actually, I find actually even more difficult to do than if you were doing it third-person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Roger was a master, and in fact, there's one of his award-winning stories, The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth. He actually begins it in second person.
Oh, wow.
Which is, like, almost impossible to carry off without turning off your reader. It's, mm-hmm. you know, you fall out of the sky, you know, you do that, and you read it, and it works. And you go, how did he do that? How did that man do that? So, yeah. Now, okay, I just brought up the caveat.
Mm-hmm.
The caveat is, if you want to be a writer, do not use all of this preparation as a procrastination technique not to write.
Which I've done many times. I just need to outline some more.
Yeah, and gamers, they use world building. And many, many, many times over the years, I've had someone come up to me at a convention and say, and they pull open their coat like they're about to show me Swiss watches. And they say, I've written this manuscript. Would you mind? And I always say, sure, I don't mind looking at it. But all too often, when I toddle back to the hotel room or a court of the restaurant or wherever we're gonna sit and talk, I read it for 5 minutes and I hand it back to them and say, great world, tell me a story in it. You're not telling me a story. You're telling me, and over here there's a mountain, and over here the dwarves have a kingdom, and over here the elves live in this floating castle in the sky because they don't like the dwarves. And I go, oh, yeah, the elves don't like the dwarves. Yeah, that's original. You know, but
it's the infamous info dump.
Yeah, but and info dumps can work. I mean, if you want to see an info dump that works in a movie, and you should never do info dumps in a movie, the beginning of 2010, the sequel to 2001, that scene in the desert with all the radar dishes, and the Russian scientist visits Haywood Floyd and sets up the entire movie in a minute and a half, and it is so beautifully written that you don't go, info dump, my eyes are glazing over. You follow every instant of it. But that's the exception. The rule is, as you say, no info dumps. Well, I need, first and foremost, to be carried along with a great story. I really don't give two hoots about arcane details of the world. They're fun to work out, but I've created 6, 7, 8 worlds now. I'm up with doing arcane details. It's like walking around the back of my car and checking if the tires aren't flat yet. You know, it's like I've done it before. I need you to tell me a story. And I need you, if you're a first-time writer, to understand that although I don't want you as the writer to fall in love with your characters because that's fatal and it shows on the page, the number one thing you can do to make me care about the story is make me care about the characters. Because then, as you just said when we discussed the Amber books, it's really about what's going to happen next with this character and that character and this other character. Because I'm interested in those characters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've always thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to see the exact same series of books that made up the Chronicles of Amber, but told from one of the other characters' viewpoint?
Oh, yeah. Benedict, perhaps. Or
Blaze. Or Brand. Yeah. Actually, yeah, Blaze was, I was thinking Blaze might be interesting because he disappears at one point. We don't know what he's doing, but he's
right.
Heavily involved in it. Yeah, or Fiona.
Fiona would be best, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She would be really interesting. Yeah, you've brought up some really interesting points. I think anybody who would like to expand, you know, into the writing world as opposed to just the gaming world can really take some of that advice to heart because it really applies, I think, to just about any kind of writing. It doesn't have to be fantasy, but like you were saying, the important things to remember is you have to eventually write if you want to be a writer, and you also need to read a lot. You know, speaking of that, now, when you go to Game Hole, were you planning on doing any of your own readings?
I might inflict some reading on people. Yeah, I probably will. Because, you know, I like reading. It's fun. You know, I put on all the funny voices, and I act it out. On the other hand, I am conscious of the fact that some people don't like to listen to readings, and some writers, I'm not going to name any names, but we've all heard some of them, are not good readers. They read like this, or even worse, they read like the kid in class who went from word to word. And, you know, you're going, get on with it.
Yeah, that would be bad. Yeah. And then from then on, whenever you read that person's works, you would be unintentionally reading it in his voice.
Yeah. And at the same time, there are some people who have accents. I could listen to them read the phone book.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Fry, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
But on the other hand, there are people whose accents just turn me off. I met Ogden Nash in, you know, when I was a young kid, and that thick accent just doesn't work for me. I had to fight through his accent to hear what he was saying. But when I read his poetry on the printed page, it was light, funny, everything. But I had to sort of fight through that if you hear the man himself. Anyway, so yeah, I will do some readings, but I'm mainly there whenever I'm at a convention, I'm there to do what the audience or group wants. So if somebody from the back of the room says, "Shut up, no more reading. God, I'm bored to tears. Tell me a story," or something, then I'll stop. Tell the story. It's not about me. It's about, you know, when you're writing, when you're game designing, it's a service industry. You're there for the gamers. You're there for the readers, not to say, "Hi, look at me. My teeth are shiny."
I agree. And that's a great attitude too. It's nice to hear somebody of your reputation to have that kind of self-modesty. You know, sometimes I have met people at game conventions, you know, that did kind of feel like, well, I'm talking, this is me, so you should be listening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a natural human tendency, and so is murder.
Yeah. Doesn't make it right, but yeah. Oh, well, you know, that makes actually kind of makes me want to ask then, now, how exactly did you get into the whole industry itself? You know, I always like to ask people when I interview them, I like to always find out two things: what got them initially into gaming, and then how did they make the jump from being one of the many gamers out there to getting to actually get kind of behind the scenes and do some work in the industry. I'm just curious, how did you get into gaming, and then how did that bring you into the industry?
Oh boy. Okay. Let's go back to my childhood.
It all began.
Okay, so I'm a toddler. Okay. We're back to that dear dawn time. This would be pre-internet, pre-color television. You know, when everything was sepia and people walked around with jerky. Okay. I was a toddler, and I had a large extended family, almost all of whom were older than me, which meant I had lots of aunts and uncles and grandparents, which meant I was often playing euchre or canasta, even though I didn't know what I was doing, or cribbage, because that's what they liked to do.
Mm-hmm.
So they would teach me, and I would play them. And as a sop to me, they'd get out their old steeplechase games, and these are ancient steeplechase games, you know, where everything's carved of wood. Mm. Parcheesi, chess. Because they wanted to have fun, too.
Sure.
And my dad was in the Canadian military, and he had some NATO simulation games. All this top-secret stuff, ho-ho. They were sort of like Kriegspiels. You know, they were fog of war exercises, mm-hmm. where you would maneuver off the board, and people would get confused about who was where, and deliberately.
Oh, and wow.
Then I went to the library all the time as a kid. I've worked in libraries all my life. But back then, I came across a whole bunch of really cool books, and they were really cool because their covers, at least, had photographs of models, as in model soldiers, model tanks, whatever. And they were Donald Featherstone's miniatures war games books. Mm-hmm. Tons of them. All sorts of them. And they talked about how you bought your box of Airfix figures, and you fought the American Civil War, or at least a little bit of it, with two cannons and two sets of troops, about 20 guys in each, and then five cavalry guys on each. Oh, okay, that was the war. And then later on, I discovered Little Wars, the H.G. Wells classic, and then my friends introduced me to Kingmaker and a lot of the early Avalon Hill games, and then later on SBI games, and then later on D&D. So I am now reading The Dragon. And I bought and read Dragon regularly from issue 19 onwards. And two things happened that spurred me to write. First of them was that TSR released Divine Right, a fun boxed fantasy board game.
Oh, yeah, that was a great one.
And it had, yeah, it was great. We loved it. We played it over and again, and it had two obvious errors. There was a site on the board called Greystaff. The rules for the site ended in mid-sentence.
Hmm.
And there was a country in the south of the the board called Shukasim. Its armies were all yellow. Well, the rules told you it had X number of armies, and the counter sheet that you punched out had more armies than that for Shukasim. Mm-hmm. So obviously, an errata needed to be written. And obviously, me, an unknown young nobody from, you know, Don Mills, Ontario, Canada, was going to write that errata based on the way we'd played the game, what seemed to work. So I wrote it and sent it into Dragon. You know, public service and all that. Sure. They hung on to it till issue 34 because they did a theme Divine Right issue then. And they published it, and another one of my fellow players wrote another Divine Right article about sieging stuff in Divine Right, and that appeared in the same issue. The second thing that happened was that Dragon revived its old featured creature column, you know, one new monster in issue, calling it the Dragon's Bestiary. And they promised that any published creature would be as official as anything printed in the monster manual, and that they'd paid $25 per monster, which was a lot of money in those days. So in my home country, Canada, where American dollars were worth about 40% more than Canadian.
Oh, yes, that would be a nice turnaround.
Yeah. Not like that anymore, but anyway, it was back then. I wrote a monster called The Cursed and sent it off, and it got printed right away in issue 30. Oh, I said, ha-ha, this is easy. So I wrote The Crawling Claw, which, you know, seems to have become a classic monster for the game while I wasn't looking. And 16 days after I mailed The Crawling Claw off to Dragon, my next issue of Dragon, number 32, came back to me with my monster in it.
Oh, that must have been a great day.
Yeah, well, okay, it was my second publication, but what it told me is, wow, they're desperate. They'll take anything. You know, I sent this off, boom, they put it in the issue. And they took my tiny Staedtler illustration. I labored at that illustration. It was the size of a postage stamp because I worked out that I was over word count. Well, they blew it up and printed it in pink, looked like I did it with pink crayon. But anyway, I started churning out monsters and firing them off. And then I decided to write an issue on gates, or portals, as later editions of the game called them. And I sent it off. It got printed in issue 37. And Kim Mohan, who was one of the editors at the time, at Dragon, and the most recent thing work I got to do with Kim was the hardcover Ed Greenwood Presents Elminster's Forgotten Realms that came out last year. You know, that was our last work together before he retired. So, I mean, we became good friends and worked on a lot of stuff over the years, but he was mightily impressed with the Gates article because it was the first article he'd ever seen submitted to Dragon Magazine that had footnotes. He hadn't expected to have, quote, deep articles. So that year, when I went to Gen Con, he invited me for a stroll out through the grounds of the University of Wisconsin Parkside so there would be nobody else around, so he could offer me the unpaid post of contributing editor, which meant they would take lots of stuff from me. As he put it, and I'm paraphrasing here, gamers love whatever it is they love, and they write articles about it. And not all of them we can use, or not all of them we can use as fast as we'd want to, or as fast as they want us to print it. And they tend to resent guys who get printed over and over and over again in the issues, and their stuff hasn't appeared yet. So, you know, if we give you a title, I said, oh, okay. So I started filling the pages of Dragon, and Kim started sending me the ecology of things to do as a series, as assignments. And he thought, this is marvelous. I've got a guy who'll write to assignment. And I thought, this is marvelous. I found a magazine that'll print anything I'll write. So I would do the assigned things, and I would say, and this other thing over here is what really turns my crank, and I'd turn out monsters and spells and magic items, the pages from the mages and all the rest of it. And, of course, the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, I love the articles you did on the Nine Hells.
Oh, thank you. I liked the first two. The Hell Revisited in 91. That was the first time I ever got heavily censored, because that went through Frank to Gary, Frank Menser and Gary Gygax, and he wrote Hell No across it because, well, what I did is I went through the monster manual and I said, hey, they have these talismans. Nobody designed them. So I wrote a complete article in which I drew 3D, you know, like by doing a three-quarter view, of all the talismans linked to each devils with the little symbols and runes on them. I was really proud of that. And I also had to figure out why Beelzebul ruled two layers and of the Nine Hells, and everybody else only ruled one. So I worked out that the only threat to Asmodeus was unique devils, as in greater devils, archdevils, being born without his permission, because that upset the balance of power, and he was on top in the current status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So I also had to figure out why, because Alex von Zorn had done that marvelous article called The Politics of Hell.
Yes, I remember that one.
Okay, well, there was Lucifer. So I thought, why is Lucifer not in the D&D? Ah, okay, we don't want to go there, but let's explain him away. So Lucifer and his consort Batna had an unauthorized child, Lucifuge, and when Asmodeus found out about it, he killed all three of them and gave the lair of hell that Lucifer had ruled to Lucifer's worst enemy, Beelzebul, and said, this is your example for all the rest of you. Any of the rest of you want to try this? This is what will happen to you. And Kim said, this is a great story. I love it. But there's no way I can print this without permission from my bosses. And they both looked at it and said, oh my God, he's talking about having kids. Oh my God, he's mentioning Lucifer. Oh my God, he's drawing sigils that'll be on the side of every church all across the United States and we'll get the blame. No!
Yeah, that was a time in TSR's history where I guess they were probably trying to get away from the whole.
You know, at the time I thought, aw, but I didn't say, oh, they're stupid of them. Oh, they should never done it. I thought, I get it. I know why you're doing it. I wanted to go there. I wanted to explain everything. And of course, there's always the problem. You want to explain everything to fill everything up, because you know, being a gamer, that any detail that can be misinterpreted will be misinterpreted. Everything down and explain everything, and if you don't, there will be years of controversy and thousands of but against that is the fact that no, here's the limitations that we're operating under, and you know, so that was a good lesson for me. Mm-hmm. But you know, I've still wanted to write that article. And every so often, I sidle up to some of the poor guys who are now at WotC and say, hey, I know a lot of water has run under the bridge since then, and this is really yesterday's battle, but I would really love to. And they go, oh, no.
Well, didn't they put out, though, that they had the I'm not as up on anything after second edition, to be honest, but I believe that they did come out with a Book of Infernal Darkness or
Hell has been reimagined and recast with each edition of the game. So it really is yesterday's battle about yesterday's things. But I've learned to let it go. But I've still wanted to get my article out there.
Well, if you ever do it, send me a copy. Okay. I really enjoyed them. Yeah, I used your information on the Hells quite extensively, because I had been running a campaign set in the Nine Hells. They came in very handy, and if anybody is interested, they can find that in some of the in 75 and 76. And
91.
Well,
revisited.
Ah.
Not that I'm keeping track. For me, those articles are another example, and I don't mean what I just talked about, but they're another example of shortcomings. If I was looking back on those articles now, mm-hmm. they were great sizzle. They missed out the steak. And by missing out the steak is, I need to know the plumbing. Every layer I'm on, and of course, usually your player characters are going to get to the outermost layer, mm-hmm. where all the outcast devils are running around, you know, the upper layer. How does it work? Where do they get their food from? And when they crap, where does it go to? Where do they get their water or whatever they drink? What do they drink? How does it cycle through? Where do the wastes go? Where does the stuff come from? That wasn't covered. Mm-hmm. Whether they sneak onto our world, our prime material plane, you know, whether it's Greyhawk or the Realms or Kryn, and snatch living cattle or slash living humans to have as slaves or just to eat. How do they get their food? That was never covered.
Yeah. I can't remember. Did you cover like commerce in those articles?
A little, but not so much commerce between our prime material plane and the Hells as I did what was inside the Hells. So, I mean, to my way of thinking, I didn't go far enough. Now, mm-hmm. from the editor's way of thinking at the time, I went plenty far, because they were already leery, not about the subject matter, but look how many pages in that issue where they were devoting to that. You know, it's already getting over long from their point of view. And then, of course, afterwards, I worked with Stephen Innes out in Vancouver to do Limbo, and that, in the end, never got printed, although his great monster, the Lelend, or Lelendi, got into the game. But in the end, the follow-up articles, we were going to do Layers of the Abyss, we were going to do Limbo with the SLAD and all the rest of it, never got to see the light of day, because I think the editors and their bosses were thinking, oh, each one of these articles paints us into a corner if we want to do an adventure set somewhere. And I said to them, the abyss is infinite. So you just make up your own new layer and set your adventure there. And what we wrote in ours doesn't affect it. Yeah, but then we have to think about it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yes. Horror.
Well, aside from that, though, you also had some other really great contributions that I've seen other people do many iterations on. You've written up a deal on the Anti-Paladin, hadn't you, in Dragon Magazine?
Oh, no, that was done in-house, actually. That was one of
my
the verboten things.
That was my mix up there.
I played with, I did show up every year just before Gen Con. Mm-hmm. I would show up at the TSR offices and annoy them. No, I mean to for a day or two beforehand, and they would let me sit in on meetings, because guess what? Nobody was getting any work done just before Gen Con or just after Gen Con in those days. You know, they just weren't. Gen Con was consuming their lives for that week. So I would sit in on some meetings, and so I think I did contribute some names and ideas to some of the types of, you know, but no, that was done in-house. That was we're finally going to go there, but we are going to do it. You know, and what they did was take four or five of the on-the-shelf articles they'd been sent, contact all the writers, say, okay, we're going to pay you this much. We're going to use a little bit of your stuff. We're going to rewrite it. And they took lumps from everybody and stirred them into the stew. You know, So, no, I can't claim credit for the Anti-Paladin, because I had caught the aversion to talking about overtly religious stuff. Mm-hmm. By then, from the staff, you know, it's almost like, this we can juicily go into. We can talk about pirates all day long. We can
They're
talk
safe.
About, you know, abominable snowman. Like, the moment we get into priests and temples, and again, that's the part of the realms that didn't get properly fully detailed at the launch of the realms, is, okay, I want every single priesthood. I don't care about, you know, the avatars of the gods. I don't care who the top religious figure, you know, the Pope equivalent is. My player character priest, what does he wear? What does she not wear? What does she eat? What can she not eat? What are her taboos? Does she face east when she does this? Does she polish the candlestick every morning? What is it that she has to do? Then write me out some prayers. Okay, these are the prayers and rituals that have to be done daily. Okay, here are the ones for the special, you know, like, say, I don't know, the last rites. You know, stuff like that might be useful for adventuring situations. I wanted to do that for each and every church, starting with the main churches, and I wanted to give every starting player character about two paragraphs that says, okay, because you worship Tempus, god of battles, far more than the general common folk. The common folk worship all the gods. They believe in all the gods, and they worship all the gods. And what that means is there's a whole lot of appeasing going on. You know, oh my goodness, soldiers are coming. Quick, pray to Tempest. Oh, it's time to plant the harvest. Quick, pray to Shanti. Okay, you know, they're doing that sort of worshiping. If you're a priest, okay, you have to have an ethos. Here's your creed you follow. Here's what you try and get other people to do. You know, do not sow in that field. Shanti does not like it. You know, that sort of stuff. And then here's the quiet, hidden, secular aims. Like, your Pope equivalent wants to become the richest man in the world, so make sure you collect lots of gold coins, or whatever it is, you know. Or your Pope equivalent wants to control Waterdeep, so every time you get a chance to either subvert or replace the Lord of Waterdeep with one of us, do it. You know, that sort of stuff. And I wanted that for every single, and of course, we just avoided all that, because, oh no, we're not going there. We're not going towards the religious thing, which is fine. That was their decision. They are the publisher. They're taking the risks of publishing. But to me, as a designer, per se, and that's the same thing, to circle back very quickly to writing fiction. You don't have to put anything in particular in your fiction, but you should think about all of it beforehand.
You should know it yourself.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Even if you're not going to put one thing about the gods in your fantasy setting into your fantasy novel, you should know all about them so that you won't get caught with your pants down contradicting yourself from page 19 at the beginning to page 539 at the end, where you said something different about the same deity. Or you said two different deities were both the deities of opening doors. You know, you have to have it worked out for you, even if it doesn't make it into the book.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting, though. I think a lot of people who, when they do start to do their world building, at least there is this interest, actually, in getting into the cool stuff. But like you said, you know, you also have to know the plumbing of the world that you're working on. You know, it may not be as exciting an area within your world building, but it's very important to know how things are working, you know, at the micro level, I guess you'd say. You know,
let me tell you very quickly, very quick story.
Oh, okay.
First time my wife was playing a player character and going through a dungeon. We opened a door and there was a very, very, very large room with a dragon in it sitting on a pile of treasure. The whole thing was an illusion, but you know. So she looked at me and said, "So why isn't the dragon drowned?" I said, "Excuse me?" And she says, "Well, if it's been sitting in this room for all these years, it would have had to pee so often. It would drown in its own pee. The whole room would be full of it." Oops.
Oh, see, she looked through the glitter and
yeah.
She saw that. Yeah, very good. I like that. Okay, speaking of having your opportunity, though, to really get, because you strike me as somebody who really likes to answer the questions, the basic questions about the worlds they build. Did you feel like you had a good opportunity to do that when you were designing, when you were creating the Forgotten Realms?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. There's a caveat there. I want to answer all the questions, but you can never answer all the questions because the world then is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's nothing left to find out.
That's right. And one of the rules, the secret rules, which isn't really secret anymore, that I hammered home when I first handed over the realms to TSR, and Jeff Grubb turned around and hammered it home to all of his designers, and he got hammered at with various freelancers too. And it was the one that came before "Don't blow up the moon." Okay? The one that came before was, for every loose end that you tie off, you have to build in three more. Because the old gray box, the realms, I put in tons of loose ends. You know, in the current clack section of news, I was putting in all sorts of things for Dungeon Masters to play with. And a few of them had tiny asterisks that told the Dungeon Master, "Go ahead and develop this. We're never going to say anything more about it. So this is yours. You can play with this. You can go anywhere you want with this." Others didn't have that asterisk. Okay. People came along and gleefully tied off those loose ends. Other designers, other fiction writers, as, you know, the decades of using the realms passed. So the commandment was, if you're going to tie something off, if you're going to answer something, if you're going to lay some mystery to rest, if you're going to tell us where that person who disappeared went to, then you have to give me more mysteries, more conundrums, more things to answer, because otherwise I'm going to stop being interested in the world.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I did answer a lot of the stuff about the realms. I have to tell you flat out that I started designing it from a few small sites outwards, as in, I imagined in my mind what a small area looked like, and one of the small areas was Undermountain's first level, and the city above it, the wards immediately above it, and another one was Shatterdale, no surprise to anybody, and another one was Evening Star. And I had them detailed in my mind down to the last bush, the last chamber pot, the last, you know, mud hole. I could tell you where the gophers were, okay? And then I designed outwards from that, but I designed according to that, meaning, okay, if this village of Evening Star exists where these two trails, these two roads, these caravan roads meet in a T-junction, why is it a T-junction? What is the barrier to the north? Oh, it's the cliffs, the plateau, and beyond that is the stone lands. Okay, so I then designed the stone lands. Okay, these busy caravan roads, they're taking caravan cargoes from one place to another, obviously. Okay, so design outwards so that they become important routes. And so everything had to mesh and fit together. And the bugger factor that came along later is after I'd pretty much designed the western half of one continent in full detail, TSR buys the world as a setting for the second edition of the game. And they say, okay, we have to put pirates here. We have to put Arabian-type stuff here. We need to have a jungle over here. We need to have a frozen waste and tundra here and endless steppes over here. Hey, Ed, where can we put the active volcanoes? Okay, so then it had to become a broad world that could take in everything, which meant I had to sit there and go, oh, well, they work best here, and they work best here. And sometimes I was literally saying to people inside TSR, well, nobody's gone over here yet, so you're safe to put X there.
So basically, you start off with three principal sites, and then building off of those, you know, you've set up essentially a core set of rules on how your world will work, using these three sites as examples. And then as models, you might say, also, you know, each other site could be smaller or bigger, but essentially following many of the same rules that your first three sites have to follow.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. The good thing for me for the realms, I think it's a strength. It predated all role-playing games. It predated D&D. It was supposed to be my setting for my own fictional stories, sword and sorcery stories. So therefore, it wasn't purpose-built with one big action thing in mind. To contrast it with Dragonlance, that was designed from the ground up as a game setting, and it was designed around this huge story. You know, the quest, the heroes of the lance, and what they were going to do against Takhesis in the end. But, I mean, that was the boss villain after you'd gone through everything else. And the problem is, it was saving the world.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for an encore? Oh, I guess we'll save the world again. Wait, there's another side of the planet we haven't been on. Detail the other side. You know, but it all felt like an anticlimax. Whereas I was designing my world primarily not around a single adventure. I was designing it to be the land of 1,000 adventures, the land of 1,000 intrigues, 1,000,000 intrigues, the land that had been rolling along for years before you got here to watch it and was going to go rolling along for years afterwards. So it was busy, it was broad, it was deep, it was complex, it was too big for any one story, which is also its strength. That's what allowed it to be the stage for all those elements that TSR needed to put into it. So they could have pirate adventures, jungle adventures, whatever.
As you just said, Forgotten Realms was not just a gaming world. It was going to be the basis of where your writings could take place and such. Whereas I think, like Kryn, I think Greyhawk was more of a essentially set up to be a gaming world. So I guess you kind of already answered my question. I was going to say, was that intentional? What led you to bring that additional depth to the Forgotten Realms?
There's two things I should say to add to it. One is, you can't appreciate the good times if you don't have the bad times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Joni Mitchell saying, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. So I like to have characters who are humorous, like Mert the Moneylender, my original, you know, main guy. He was a bit of a wheezing buffoon. Mm-hmm. So if he's playing the clown all the time, and being amiable and so on, I have to show you that this whole world isn't just laughs and pratfalls. There are lurking darkness here. There's a reason why people laugh to deal with. So there's that. And the other thing is, and I agree with you, if you're designing just for the world, for the adventure, for one adventure, yes, you do get less depth. Whereas if you've already got all these detailed things in there, you have to design around them.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's already this mountain range here, and it has this story. And there's already this huge spreading desert, a Norok, and it has a story behind it. You have to design around them. So inevitably, you get more depth because you're dealing with the obstacles and you're weaving them into the tapestry. But also, once I had a group of regular players playing in the Forgotten Realms, they demanded depth without sitting there and saying, hey, Ed, you know, just the way they played. They were all heavy duty role players, by which I mean they wanted to speak as their characters, act as their characters, which meant their characters had to have day jobs. Their characters had to have a past and a family, maybe family feuds. Their characters had to have what second edition called secondary skills. They had to do things. You know, did they fletch arrows, whatever. And all of that leads to more depth. You're building it in without thinking about it because they need it every play session.
Mm-hmm.
So the world is becoming detailed because you don't want to have just one supplier of barrels and casks in the kingdom. That doesn't make any sense when you're surrounded by trees and so on. So you want to have tons and tons of coopers in various towns, competing ones. And then you get into, this guy will undercut this guy. Oh, now you've got the trade network set up. Okay, well, why are they bothering? Oh, what do they need to transport? Oh, and who are the rich people who are buying all this stuff? Oh, Sembia right next door. Okay, and the Sword Coast and the endless, insatiable people that Waterdeep serves as a port over there, so they're going to ship it on these long caravans. Oh, and long caravan runs, that's what you'd need to have adventurers for, because there are lots of monsters that know. And of course, some of the monsters are human. They're brigands, you know, bandits, whatever you want to call them. They're waiting for these regular caravans to come trooping past on this same route. Dinner has arrived, you know. So that's when they'd hire adventurers. We need a bunch of guys to wear armor and ride horses and look really impressive, so they'll wait for a weaker caravan.
Well, speaking of characters,
yep.
How did Elminster come to be?
Elminster was originally in the game. In my home campaign, he was the fussy, scholarly, usually elsewhere, pain in the ass wizard who I could use to feed lore to my player characters when they needed it. When they needed it and when they were smart enough to stop and ask for it. So he was, if you remember the movie Excalibur, Nicholson playing Merlin. Okay, so take away the red hair, take away the skull cap and earring, but leave the manner. You know, the, ooh, I didn't foresee this, or, for it is the doom of men that they forget. You know, that sort of stuff. You put that sort of whimsy and delivery in, and that's Elminster. Now, when I started writing dragon articles, I had a secondary use for Elminster, and it grew out of being a shy kid, and Canadian to boot. I thought it was terribly arrogant to write an article for Dragon saying, hi, my name's Ed Greenwood. You don't know me, but, you know, I've just thought of a new way of rolling dice. So, ha-ha, here it is. I thought, God, I could never do that. That's everything I hate in a person. So, the other problem is, if I'm speaking as an author in my voice, it's a game in which people expect, you know, there are three trolls in room A, and their hit points are, and they are guarding a chest. You know, you have to be specific. But I could take care of both those problems at once by saying, well, the wizard Elminster tells me that there are rumors of trolls in those ruins, and it's Elminster's considered opinion that all of those Sembians are utter dolts, but you didn't hear it here. You know, so I could take that step back. I could build in the elbow room that dungeon masters need. Because remember, in those days, everybody in the industry who could get their hands on Dragon read it.
Yeah.
So all the players read it, and all the dungeon masters read it. So everybody knew it was in Dragon. So I could allow the dungeon masters the leeway I needed. And at the same time, I could say things obliquely. I could hint without stating baldly. So that's where Elminster came from. He was never supposed to be on stage the way he became, because of course this is a business. So I am usually told what should be in my next book. And quite a few years ago, TSR decided that everybody was going to have an iconic character. You know, Bob Salvatore, Driss Doerden is his iconic character. Tracy Hickman, Strahd, the vampire, is his iconic character. Ed Elminster is your iconic character. But I want to write about Mert. Never mind. Elminster is your iconic character. And the next step was, and he's going to be in every book. So if you look at my current books for Wizards of the Coast, guess what? By contract, they're all Elminster novels. I could put other things in them, but they've got to be Elminster novels. So
you could put Mert in.
Yes, and I have the last two of them. But he does little cameos where he's sitting, you know, at a table drinking while in the background. But they have to be Elminster novels. So I would not have had Elminster front and center as much as he's become, because he was popular with readers. He was popular with gamers. Yeah. I know there are some who hate Elminster, but there are an awful lot more who says, hey, you didn't put Elminster in this one. What's wrong?
It's I call it the Wolverine cycle. Yes. You know, it's like the X-Men, you know, back if you read the X-Men back in the early 70s, Chris Claremont, you know, when he had Wolverine, he was just one of the team.
Yep.
But by the 90s, he was the team.
Well, yeah.
That's who everybody wanted to see, so that's who you got to see. But yeah, it sounds very similar to that. Elminster became so popular that that is what people wanted you to show them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Originally, I used to tell people that Elminster was Ronald Reagan in Death Valley days.
Mm.
He was the old storyteller who right at the beginning would say, well, a tough time in the valley this week. And then the camera would literally pan up over his shoulder and into the episode. And for half an hour or whatever, how long it was, you wouldn't see that character again. And then right at the end, the camera would pull back down over his shoulder and he'd be sitting in front of you again and say, well, see you next week. and that that's what I wanted Elminster to be. He
sure.
was your sort of guide.
Your guide, yeah.
Yeah. So you were seeing the realms through his eyes, which was my big out for the company. If somebody said, you know, there are 15 beholders who rule the city and they dye themselves blue. And then 5 years later, the next guy writing mentions that there are the four red beholders who run the city. And everybody, all the fans go, hey, wait a minute. There are 16 and they're blue. You got it wrong, dummy. Oh, no. This is how it's been all along. Don't trust what Elminster told you.
Ah.
You see, that was my unreliable narrator. My
unreliable narrator, yeah.
But of course, there are some people who hate that. They say, I want the truth. I'm paying good money for the truth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there'll always be that one person, kind of like comic book guy from The Simpsons, you know.
Yes.
Don't understand. That is not accurate.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's always going to be people out there who I've heard other game designers oftentimes say, you know, the story of, you know, when players would come up to them and ask them a question about something, they want this definitive answer, you know, and then a lot of these designers would say, well, it's what you want it to be.
Yes. And they don't want to hear that.
They don't want to hear that.
But they don't.
They want a definitive answer.
And there's the danger. Remember Life of Brian?
Mm-hmm.
Remember where Brian is pleading with the crowd? No, you have to make up your own minds. You have to go away and think for yourselves. You know?
Exactly. They don't want to hear that.
No. Just give me the guidance. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I guess you need somebody like Brian's mom to come out and say, go away.
He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy.
He's a naughty boy.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well,
yeah, just before she comes, you're all individuals. Yes, they say in chorus. We're all individuals.
They say it in unison.
Yes. And of course, there we have just, and it's legitimate. We're not infringing on copyright by discussing Monty Python. We're discussing it because it is the way in which most North Americans get into role-playing the funny voices during the game. They do Monty Python stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So it's relevant. No.
You know, what's funny, we were not too long ago, a couple of years ago, we were at the convention, the Dead Game Society, and one of my fellow co-founders of the DGS, Michael, he's known for doing these wild costumes. And, you know, he did one, a Marvel game for, he called it Kistastrophe, and he came as Gene Simmons. He built the battle armor and everything. But in this one, he did a Call of Cthulhu game, I think, but it was based around the Holy Grail. And so he came in as the less intelligent brother of I think there was a monk in Holy Grail, the one who carried around the holy hand grenade, but he came as that person. And by the end of the adventure, he just stopped narrating the adventure. He just said, you know what? This isn't going to work. Just stop everything. And he started taking off the robe, and underneath he had the lumberjack.
Yeah.
That's how the game ended. He started singing the lumberjack song. But you're right. And I bring it up, though, because it's a classic example of how he was able to take a group of strangers at a table and immediately get them to, guess, what's the word? They could connect to the type of role play he wanted, and they instantly gelled, and they could start doing the voices, and they could really get into it.
Yeah, and that's great, because it's all about, you know, breaking ice and having a good time, and that can be really difficult. Yeah, particularly at a large convention where people have traveled from all over the world. There might be language barriers as well as cultural barriers. Everybody's shy, you know, they're not with their group. And if they are with their group as a little nucleus of two or three people, they seem to dominate because they take comfort in each other's company and they work as a group, and everybody else in around the table feels intimidated because these guys are working together as a group. You know, and yeah, it is. It's interesting, too, because people have very different ways of playing Dungeons & Dragons. Some of them play it almost like a football game. You know, they form a huddle. And the quarterback tells you, okay, this round the thief's going to do this, and I want the two priests on the right firing, you know. And it's like, hey, okay, hold on there. If you're going to do that, all my monsters are going into a huddle here. Okay, now, this round, you're going to bite so-and-so, and you know those two priests he had? You're going to fireball them. You know, yeah. And they go, hey, wait, no fair. Hey, you guys are doing it.
Oh my gosh! I'd love to actually see you run one of the one of your games at some point. I'm hoping at Game Hole Con did you say you would be running games at Game Hole?
Yes. Well, okay. I was being vague because I only sent off the descriptions of what I wanted to do today.
Oh,
so the Game Hole guys actually haven't had a chance to see or approve them yet. Yes, I will be running. I hope to run three different adventures. All is set in the realms. All second edition. Don't worry about the your edition preferences, because I will be telling you as DM, just roll some dice. Okay, cool. What are you doing this round? You know, I won't be worrying about rules, and I will pre-gen the characters. You know, we're not going to waste any time on that. But, you know, if you look at the spells that I've given you on the sheet, and you say, ugh, can I change these? My answer will be, yes, of course. Tell me what you're changing them to. You have 5 minutes, da-da-da, we're done. Because we're going to play. We won't have however amount of time, because time is precious always, so let's just play. Let's have a good time. You know, I don't want to do rules arguments or those
minutes
where we all read our rule books and decide what our spells are going to be.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, if the runner is good, and you certainly sound like it, then it doesn't really matter what edition you're playing, because in character, your characters don't know they're in an edition to begin with.
That's right, yeah. And I am going to, as the guy running the game, I am going to shift what I do depending on who's at the table. If I've got six shy 12-year-old girls sitting at the table with their parents standing behind them, I am not going to go to
the nine hells.
I'm not going to go to the same places in the game as if I have six 50-something bearded, overweight gamers with T-shirts that say, "Kiss me, I'm Thulu," on them. And they are expecting me to know every biddle mechanic of the rules, and they're expecting me to do this, and they want to min-max, and they want to, you know, because to them it's like competitive, whereas the young girls want a story. But they want to lose themselves in a story. They don't know the rules. They don't want to have to stop and think about the rules. So I will say, you see that triangular dice? Just throw it up in the air and let's see what it says when it lands. You know, that's as much as I'm going to go towards rules with them. And they're going to know when I ask them to do that, okay, this is one of those decision times where it's taken out of your hands. The rest of it is going to be their own decisions. If they invent something, if they decide, oh, I'm not going to run away from the guard. I'm going to run up to him and kiss him and say, I've been looking for someone like you all my life. You know, I'm going to say, great, cool, you're going off the rails. This is what I wanted. You know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love it when that happens. I mean, I rarely ever get a chance to play when I go to conventions, because I tend to run games the majority of the time I'm there. Really, I haven't played in a game probably in 2 years. But your game, I might just be trying to wrangle a seat into. I think it'd be a really good time.
Well, yeah, I want it to be fun. I can't always promise it will end up being fun, because, you know, that's the other thing. It's not my game. It's the player cure's game. And if the players decide, okay, we're going to do this, or we're just going to sit down and wait for something to happen, okay, it's up to you.
Yeah, I always tell my players when I first sit down with them at a convention, I say, okay, before we even go into this, I just want you guys to know that you're going to get out of this game what you put into this game.
Yeah.
And if you don't put anything into this game, there's nothing I can give you out of this game.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I mean, there are, and I've noticed this with playing with my regular players. There are times when people need to just step out of the game for a minute and unwind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost impossible to do without derailing the game or sidetracking the game when it's all of you together in one room. So if they want to stop and talk about something really cool that was on Game of Thrones last night, sure, let them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a competitive tournament situation, I usually have three artificial rules. One, don't split up the party.
Mm-hmm.
Two, anything that comes out of your mouth comes out of your character's mouth. So no standing there discussing how you're going to kill the orc when you're 5 feet from the orc and have the orc not hear you.
Well, let's sneak up behind him. The orc is now turning to look at you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the third thing is, if you need to ask me something or somebody else something, like player to player, could you pass me the chips or pass me a can of pop? Or player to DM, I've lived here all my life. Have I ever seen this guy before? Or have I ever seen this coat of arms before? You know, that's a legitimate thing for them to step out of character and ask me.
Mm-hmm.
But if I say, try and remember to preface, and, you know, that gets forgotten in the first half hour. But it doesn't matter. It set the tone. It set the style. So they've figured out that what they say their character says, and there are just going to be a few exceptions to that, and which is what I wanted. Now, sometimes that leads to embarrassing bits at the beginning where everybody's self-conscious. Prithee, good my lord, dost not thou how I trow? You know, so you get a lot of that. And you also get large, heavy, bearded guys saying, I'm playing the elven princess, boy. You know.
I'm a pixie.
Yeah. And you go, yeah, that's nice. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nice ankle.
Uh-huh.
You know, you know, but I mean, we get over that and you get rolling. And every group establishes its own style and dynamic. And I really don't care what that style dynamic is, as long as it works for them. Because I am wasting, if it comes to that, 3 or 4 hours of their lives that they can't have back. So if at the end of 3 or 4 hours, they go, that was 3 or 4 hours well spent, let's do that again, that was cool, good, my work here is done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've probably taken up about as much of your time as you can probably afford, but what I would like to say is I'm looking forward to seeing you at the Game Hole Convention. I was there last year at their first one, and me and the other guys from the Dead Game Society had a blast. We really had a good time. It was a good convention, very well ran. So I think you'll be impressed. And I thank all the people that are listening when they go. I think they'll be impressed. And I think they'll have a great opportunity to meet a very creative and funny man, Red Greenwood.
You. I can't wait to go. This to me sounds like a really cool con. I haven't been able to attend the last few of them when I was asked to because we were having these secret summits at Wizards of the Coast at the same time, you know. But they were
secret, so nobody could know.
Yes, that's right. I have to say, sorry, I'll be washing my cat this way that week. I'm sorry, it's cat washing week. But I'm looking forward to this. This should be cool. And, you know, it's been years since I've been able to get to Madison. Hey, it's been years since I've been able to get back to Wisconsin. So, yeah, I would love to, you know.
Now, will people be able to get a copy of A Platter of Surprises?
Sure.
When they go to the convention, I didn't know if you would have some of the books with you or not.
Oh, no, they're all, as far as we know right now, they're all going to be e-books. Okay, that's the thing. That's the thing I should actually, you know, just sort of emphasize for everybody. I write tons of stuff, not just in the Realms. The Realms is my life's work. I will never stop loving the Realms and working on the Realms. But I write all sorts of other stuff. And this is a sort of experiment of, hey, I wrote these for fun. What can I do with them? Hey, let's share them with people. So at the moment, they're just ebooks. Who knows? There may be physical platters, but there won't be physical platters, as far as I know now, at Game Hole. Because I won't get far enough along with that. But I have plans. Boy, do I have plans. Drop by theedverse.com where I, you know, you'll see me sitting in my cellar talking to you through my computer's little webcam and regular little blogs. And I write all sorts of stuff that's available for free to read there. And I just have fun. And we sell stuff. And as I come up with ideas of things to sell, we will put them up there. And you can go, really, Ed? A book on lampshades? Wow.
I've been waiting for that.
Are these erotic lampshades?
No. it's the lamp from A Christmas Story.
Oh, yes. Yes, leg lamps. Yes, you can apparently buy those in all sorts of different sizes. I need to furnish my house. Yeah, no.
Now, if only there was a book about them.
Ah. Hey, wait. There's a need, a burning need I am dying to fulfill. And
you can fill that niche.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much, okay. Ed. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
This was fun.
All right. Well, guys, remember out there, once again, you can meet Mr. Greenwood. Just go to the Game Hole Convention, which, again, is at the Sheraton Madison Hotel in Madison, Wisconsin, and the convention is November 7th to the 9th. And I believe you can already go onto their website at www.gameholecon.com. To register for events. So once again, thank you very much, Ed. I've loved talking to you today.
A pleasure. It was great fun to talk to you too.